Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for September 16, 2004. This is Doug Henwood. A little bit behind schedule thanks to the New York City subway. Today, September 16, 2004, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got two guests up tonight. Mark Levitin of the Community Service Society will be talking about poverty in New York City, which is very high, but at least not rising. There's some comfort in that, I suppose, and we'll talk to him about the reasons why. And then a little after 5:30, we'll speak with Carol Brightman, who is the author of a new book from Verso called Total Insecurity, The Myth of American Omnipotence. And since we're running a little behind schedule, just a quick run through the economic headlines before we get to Mark Levitin. The usual weekly tally of first-time jobless claims, people who lose their jobs and head over to the unemployment office for benefits, to sign up for benefits. That was up 16,000 last week, although following on a 43,000 decline the previous week. And it does seem to have stabilized around the area of 330,000, 340,000. So that's not a boom level number. It's not a recession level number. It's okay, but not great. If I degrade it, I'd give it a B. The weekly measure of consumer attitudes compiled by ABC News and Money Magazine was unchanged last week, still minus 7, which is actually about where the index has been since it began some 20 years ago. That's about the average of the index since it began some 20 years ago. And people's deterioration in their appreciation of the state of the national economy was mildly offset by an improvement in the state of their personal finances. And I noted here several weeks ago there's a big gap between the way Republicans and Democrats view the economy, that gap almost unprecedentedly wide. It's actually slightly wider, record-settingly wide a few weeks ago. It's narrowed a bit, but it's still very, very high by by the historical standards. So very strange partisan divergence between the way people are seeing the economy without any kind of precedent since ABC began tracking these numbers in 1990. The Federal Reserve banks, many of them do regional surveys of what's going on with the state of their regional economies, particularly their manufacturing economies. We had two of those come out in recent days, one from the Philadelphia Federal Reserve, which showed a very sharp decline, still showing expansion in manufacturing in the Philadelphia area, but well off the pace of a couple of months ago. The New York's Fed, however, the Empire State Manufacturing Survey, showed an increase, and there also seemed to be very great regional disparities in the state of the economy, aside from the partisan ones I mentioned a little earlier. And it's very hard to tell one story about the U.S. economy at this point. It seems to be the different sectors are having very different experiences, different regions having very different experiences, and also different parties and different income levels having very different experiences. So the United States is looking rather disunited, at least in the economic sense right now, and also the political sense as well. The Federal Reserve reporting the other day that industrial production barely increased in the month of August, it too is in a weakening trend. I think a lot of economic indicators have been in a weakening trend. It was also reported the other day that retail sales in the U.S. Were down 0.3% in the month of August, dragged down by weak performance in the automobile sector. People are not buying as many cars. They've been buying cars like crazy throughout this recession and the so-called recovery, and maybe they're just a little saturated with maybe their vehicular libidos are sated right now. But in any case, vehicle sales off, that's not too good news for the manufacturing sector, which is still quite important in the economy, and autos are still quite important in the manufacturing sector. It was reported that Consumer Price Index for the United States also showing very slow increase, some of the fears that a lot of people had about inflation being driven higher by oil prices, that does not seem to be coming to pass. Very modest inflation rate of last month. So the Federal Reserve can relax a little bit if it's worried about inflation. And also, the OECD, which is an organization, think tank, sponsored by the rich, mostly the rich industrial countries based in Paris, compiles a set of leading economic indicators for its member countries, and that is also weakening. Almost all the countries it covers, the U.S., Western Europe, Japan, Canada, all these are showing weakening performance. So it's signaling economic slowdown pretty much in the whole northern hemisphere. Not a recession yet by any means, but a substantial economic slowdown. And the Federal Reserve, though, is persisting in its view that the economy is strong and can withstand or even needs a round of higher interest rates. So they're going to meet next week, set interest rate policy, and it looks like they're going to raise interest rates a notch or two. They may be wrong about the state of the economy, but we shall see. They are still concerned that interest rates are too low and they will push rates higher. Let's hope they're right, and let's hope that it doesn't deepen the slowdown into something a little nastier. And then finally, a political note. It was just released about an hour ago, actually. I just got this press release as I was leaving the office. The Pew Center for People in the Press, which does a very active polling operation, reports that George Bush's vast lead in the polls that opened up just after the Republican convention has now disappeared, and the race is once again a statistical dead heat. 46-46 among registered voters, among likely voters, which is a very difficult thing to define, especially these days with heightened passions. Bush has an insignificant, statistically meaningless lead of 47-46 over Kerry. The poll also reports that people are looking ahead with great interest to the debates, which should be coming up fairly soon. So a lot riding on those. And an interesting note on polling is about 7% of the U.S. population is cell phone only. That population is disproportionately young, and younger people probably are skewed towards the Democrats. So it may be that they're not getting properly polled. So the dead heat may not be quite a dead heat. And finally, after that rushed bit of review, we're now joined on the line by Mark Levitin, who is a senior policy analyst with the Community Service Society in New York City. Welcome to WBAI, Mark. Mark, are you with us?
I can hear you.
Okay, now we got you.
Great.
All right, welcome to the air.
Good to be there.
It's a little delayed, so a little rushed, so apologies for the slight delay in bringing you on. But you're reporting that the New York City poverty rate is essentially unchanged, even though in the nation it rose a bit last year. So to first give us the rundown, what do the numbers look like?
Well, poverty rate in New York City is very high. It's about 21% of the population. About one out of five New Yorkers live below the poverty line. Just to put that number in contrast, the poverty rate for the nation as a whole was 12.5%, about one in eight Americans living below the poverty line. So we have an enormous number, 1.7 million people in poverty in New York City. That's the level. The report discusses the trend in poverty, and here we see something really quite unusual, and that is when the recession hit New York and the nation, it brought to a halt the decline in poverty we saw in the second half of the 1990s. But as recession sort of rotted into this long period of jobless recovery, this almost 3 years without any job growth, we saw poverty increase across the nation, but we haven't seen an increase in poverty in New York City.
Now, before we get to the reasons for that and analyzing it, the poverty rate for New York City is based on the national poverty line, right, which is about $18,000 for a family of four?
Right. It's $18,660 for a family of two adults, two children. If we were talking about one parent, two children, it would be $14,824. So we're talking about an extremely modest standard here.
And this, of course, makes no adjustment for the high cost of living in New York City.
Right. The poverty rate in Manhattan, the poverty threshold in Manhattan is the same as it is in Mississippi.
And do we have any idea of what the poverty rate would look like if it were adjusted for cost of living?
Well, it would be much higher.
Yes.
I couldn't make up a number for you, but it might be, you know, up by a third.
And of course, the poverty, I should always, whenever I talk about this, I like to emphasize that the poverty line in the United States is an absolute measure. That is, it's not measured relative to average incomes, but in fact, it was set about 40 years ago and has been just adjusted for inflation ever since. So, in theory, a poverty line today has the same buying power as the poverty line of 1960.
Right, in theory.
In theory, yeah. It's very difficult to do these things over a long period of time, but this is a very undemanding measure of poverty, no matter how you slice it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at a chart that you have in your report of the poverty rate in New York City,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like it bounces between 20% in good years and 25% in bad years, but there's no really long-term downtrend in it.
Right. If you look at the last two decades, look at the 80s and the 90s, you see a very consistent pattern in the data. When the economy is sort of at full tilt in the city, where we're at the peak of the business cycle, the poverty rate is about 20%. And when the economy slows down and people lose jobs, the poverty rate climbs to 25%. And that's the story of the 80s. That's the story of the 90s. So far in the new decade, we seem to be having a somewhat different story. And poverty so far has not jumped in this recession the way it did in the prior two recessions.
But if we look at the economy of the late 90s, it was a boom by most standards. It was we had the lowest nationally. We had the lowest unemployment rates in a generation. We had in New York City, you know, Wall Street was going like gangbusters. They're theoretically spreading around a lot of money. Why is it so intransigent? Why can't we get that poverty rate below 20?
Well, that is a good question. I think it's a combination of many things. But I think the most important thing really to keep in mind is the city labor market. I mean, you mentioned that the national unemployment rate was 4% in 2000, but in New York it was 5.7%. And if we looked at something maybe more important than the unemployment rate, the share of the population that was employed, we'd see even bigger disparities between New York City and the rest of the nation. One of the things that distinguishes New York is that really across almost every demographic group, we have a very small share of the population that's employed.
And it was Community Service Society did that stunning report on, was half of black men don't have a job?
Right. In 2003, we found that only 52% of black men in New York were employed.
Which is a stunningly low number. But let's look in the bright side of things. Why hasn't the poverty rate gone up markedly in this recession and this recovery, which effectively feels almost like an extension of the recession?
Well, the story, I think, is who got whacked, if you want to put it that way. You have to keep in mind that poverty is a family affair. An individual is poor because they live in a poor family. So we talked about the poverty thresholds. They're measured against total family income. And so if you are a young person living at home and you lose your job, that is going to affect the economic well-being of your family. But typically, it wouldn't drive your family below the poverty threshold, unless they were really, really on the edge. If you were a single mother and you lost your job, very high probability that your family would then fall into poverty. And when we look at the distribution of job loss in this recession, what we see is that it was much more intense for men, particularly younger men, than it was for women. And when we look specifically at single mothers, they actually were able to increase their rate of job holding during this period where the city economy was contracting. It's highly unusual, but I think that that really kept the most vulnerable to poverty families above the poverty threshold.
I was speaking with Mark Levitin, who is a senior policy analyst with the Community Service Society of New York, and the author of a just published study of poverty in New York City in 2003. And I should say that because of New York City's, the sample size from which these numbers are drawn is pretty small, to compensate for that, we use two-year averages. So we're talking about the 2002-2003 average versus, you know, other two-year periods.
That's right.
But do we have, it seems that 2003 didn't, there wasn't a great recovery in 2003 because the job market was still barely getting off the mat.
That's right.
Now, what is the reason for that different performance? Young men doing so badly, single mothers doing reasonably well for single mothers. Was there something in the industrial or occupational mix?
I think it has to do with the city's industry mix. And in particular, what's now described as the educational and health services sector of the economy. From 2000 to 2003, the city lost approximately 200,000 jobs. But in that period, that sector, education and health services, grew by 40,000 jobs. So it bucked the trend very dramatically. About 75%, three-quarters of the workers in that industry are women. Another way of putting it is that one out of three working women in New York City is employed in that sector. And I think that a lot of the story here is the continued growth in that heavily female sector during this downturn was able to provide enough women, in particular enough single mothers, with employment to keep the poverty rate from jumping up.
What kind of jobs are we talking about there?
Well, I mean, these are not very well-paid jobs for most women in this industry. We're talking about people who work as orderlies or aides, or they may be serving food or, working as custodians. These are low-paid jobs. But remember, the poverty threshold is so modest that, a modest salary, if you can work full-time year-round, will lift the family above that threshold.
And as you pointed out in the report, for a family of four, that's about $9.66 an hour. If you have a full-time year-round job, then that will get you above the poverty line. And I think to a lot of people, a job paying under $10 an hour is not a great one.
That's right. So, I mean, there's a lot of good news here, but let's not get into a kind of a situation of it's been down so long, it looks like up to me. We're dealing with a very, very modest standard of well-being. You have to keep that in mind when we talk about poverty.
Now, the recession was considerably milder this time than the one of about 10 years ago, the one of the early 90s. What happened? Why is it so different here?
Well, that is actually a very interesting question, because you think about the big decline in the stock market and the contraction on Wall Street, and then of course the terrorist attacks on 9/11, which had a pretty big impact on the city economy. Yet, the when we look at job loss, if we want to look at that as kind of the measure of the decline. There's not that as much job loss in this recession as we had in the early 90s. And it looks as if, it's some of the service industries. We talked about education, health services, which kept growing. Other service industries were able to bounce out of the recession, in a pretty short period of time. And I'm thinking of the hospitality sector. So that's hotels, restaurants, becoming a much larger and more important sector of the economy. Well, tourism was shattered by 9/11, but by the middle of 2002, people were coming back to the city and spending money in the city. And that provided a fair amount of employment. And that sector, again, is one that employs people who are vulnerable to poverty.
And looking at this table in the report, manufacturing, which I guess means garment work and such, took a really pretty bad hit in the last 3 years.
Yes, it has. It's declined, by 51,000 jobs in just 3 years.
Yeah, bad news there. As I recall, also the early 90s recession started essentially after the 87 stock market crash and went on for years and years. We're bleeding jobs for many consecutive years, and that just didn't happen this time around.
No, it seems like this recession is somewhat milder.
And Alan Krueger has a piece in today's Times writing about the resilience of the New York City economy after 9/11, which was surprising to him, it seemed, and certainly surprising to me. You'd think that given the fact that the city economy is more dependent than ever on Wall Street, it would have taken a bigger hit than it really did.
Well, there's something good about that, something hopeful that there's something about New York that is attractive to business despite all the complaints about high taxes and high costs and congestion and all other quality of life problems. People want to do business here, and we have to build on that to spread the wealth more equitably.
Takes a licking and keeps on ticking. Now, should we conclude from the experience that we were talking about earlier with single mothers doing not so badly that welfare reform has been a great success?
Well, I would say that's a little hasty, because when you look at the data for the nation as a whole, you see an uptick in poverty. You see an uptick in poverty for families headed by single mothers, and you, of course, have seen a decline in employment among single mothers across the nation. So I think, really, this is not a story about welfare reform. This is a story about the peculiar nature of the city labor market. And the difference between New York and the nation isn't welfare policy or the way welfare policy was implemented. It's really about the labor market and labor market dynamics.
And even though things haven't gotten markedly worse in the last few years, we should, of course, remember that a 20% plus poverty rate is still very, very high. We're talking about, 1.7 million people. That's a lot of our fellow New Yorkers that are living on the edge, materially speaking. Is there anything the city can do about it, or are we hostage to the national economy, the global economy, and national policy?
Well, we are in terms of the big, you know, economic picture. But I think that there are things that the city can do. In terms of addressing the needs of the poor, we could do a much better job at making sure that people who are eligible for public benefits receive them. And the city has not done the job it could in that score. I mean, think about food stamps. And this is kind of a freebie for the city because this is all federal money. And perhaps 40 to 50% of the people who are eligible for food stamps in New York City don't get them. So this is the equivalent of hundreds of dollars a month of extra income that they could get, that they need. It's money that would be spent in the city, so there's a multiplier effect. It would be good for the city economy. It would particularly help small retailers in low-income neighborhoods. The city should be much more aggressive about getting people into the food stamp program.
All right, we have to end it there. Thanks for joining us. Community Service Society website, that's cssny.org.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, cssny.org. Thanks for joining us, Mark Levitin. Mark Levitin is a senior analyst with the Community Service Society, which, as its tagline says, Fighting Poverty, Strengthening New York. He is the author of a just published report from them on their annual look at poverty in New York City. Let's take a little break, and we'll be back with the rest of Behind the News.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
And I can't say how happy I was to hear Iggy Pop do that station ID. Thank you, Michael. This is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, and we'll be back to speak with Carol Brightman after this bit of punk apocalypse from Bad Religion.
Fun. I read her promise of prosperity.
And that was Bad Religion from, I think, 1984, The Hippie Killers. Our Apocalypse, 1981, Teenage Vagrants Looking for Some Fun. I think it's about the onset of the Reagan years and their view of it, killing hippies, which was, of course, what the Reagan years were partly about. From 1984 punk music to the Federal Reserve and monetary policy. Just a quick observation here. Ben Bernanke and some of his, who is a member of the Federal Board of the Federal Reserve System, and some of his colleagues, a couple of economist colleagues, have done a report, a study, which they discovered that talking really influences the markets. The markets, so it's like we're told that the financial markets are hard-headed and rational and skeptical and dispassionate, all those wonderful scientific things. But the Federal Reserve, they've discovered, was able to talk interest rates lower, long-term interest rates lower, over the last couple of years, just by saying that they were going to be very patient about raising interest rates. And apparently the market believed them. That kept long-term interest rates lower than they otherwise would have been, they conclude. So it does seem that a lot of sweet talk from the Federal Reserve can pacify the markets and make them do things that they wouldn't otherwise do. They call this, actually, in the report, policymaking by thesaurus. For a long period of time, in 2003, they said that they were going to they could be accommodative for a considerable period of time, and they changed those words very slowly over the next year and a half. They changed considerable period, and then they changed it to patient. Mm-hmm. And then they said that they could believe that the accommodation could be removed at a pace that is likely to be measured. So all these word games they were playing with the markets were very, very successful in keeping them calm and not worried about deflation or deep recession or any kind of other thing. So it's amazing what these markets, who like to talk about how free of the state they are, and how the state really is a malevolent force in the economy, how in practice the state can be a big security blanket for nervous markets, and when Daddy Fed speaks, the markets listen. And now we're joined on the line by Carol Brightman, who is the author of the book Total Insecurity, The Myth of American Omnipotence, just published by Verso. Welcome to WBAI, Carol Brightman.
Yes, hi.
Thanks for joining us. And it says in the jacket you were the editor in the 1960s of the Viet Report. What was just remind us what that was all about.
Well, that was an anti-war magazine. It was out for about 3 years, from 1965 to 1968. And it came out before the press was really running any information on Vietnam that was coming from other than AP or UP. It was pretty much, and it was distributed by in bulk to teach-ins, huge distributions to teach-ins, mostly free. And I think we had a subscription number of maybe 12,000 people who actually subscribed to it.
And since you reported on the war and wrote about it, how similar does the experience of Iraq look to you?
Well, when I started this book, which was really in the fall of 2002, it seemed similar. There were many similarities, and as it's developed, and as I wrote on, and as it and even after, it's become totally different. I mean, this is just a disaster, the Iraq War, and it was not arranged with anything like the care. Not that the Vietnam, the attention that was given to strategy in the case of Vietnam didn't pan out. There was at least a strategy. And, of course, there was the Cold War, which was a long, you know, gave a context to Vietnam. The similarity that I saw in the beginning was that with John F. Kennedy and Bush, the present Bush, that they both were invading new regions for the U.S. They were invading regions that, if they had not taken over, would have been abandoned by previous empires. In the case of Vietnam, it was the French and Southeast Asia or Indochina. And in the case of Iraq, in the case of the Middle East, it was the Soviet Union and to a certain degree European countries who still maintain, of course, commercial relations with all those countries. But the idea was in the case of Iraq, was that the U.S. would roll in and, had rolled out of Saudi Arabia after 9/11 and would set up shop, four or five big bases, and then would take on Iran and Syria. And that whole conundrum of causes and effects, which was put forward by the neoconservatives largely and most articulately, none of which came to pass. And that was all within, a matter of months, whereas in the case of Vietnam, it took a matter of years for the message to get across to Americans, I think.
And, of course, another difference within our own political scene here is that it took years for an anti-war movement to develop around Vietnam. And
that's right.
In this case, we had an anti-war movement before the war even started.
Well, that's true. But I think we're still at the beginning of our movement, the movement that's going to be against... I don't think it's, now that we're speaking right now in the shadow of the elections, and there's a lot of attention on get everything done really quick, and then it's kind of election-oriented. But I think this is, even though it's true we were demonstrating before the war started, I think the real organizing will happen, in the next few years against the war, because neither Bush nor Kerry have a way of pulling out, unless they just pull out, one or the other. What's happening right now is so terribly serious that you almost think maybe that will happen, that they will, pull out without much behind them. But they haven't Bush hasn't indicated that yet.
Yeah, and there's a story on the front page of the Times today saying that the national intelligence estimate of the prospects in Iraq are very pessimistic, much more so than the last report, which I think came from earlier in the year. Bush, although he's publicly talking up the possibilities of resolving things pleasantly, actually his advisors are giving him a very gloomy picture.
Yes.
But I think a lot of us who opposed the war actually thought that Bush might get his way, that he would have a rollover in Iraq, and then they would move on to remake the map of the Middle East according
right.
to their fantasies. It hasn't really worked out that way. Do you think they really knew what they were doing?
Of course they didn't. No, but there was another, go back to Vietnam, there was another similarity in the beginning, which was to create bases that were really surrounding China. This is all my, this is my speculation, and I'm thinking of Central Asia, the bases in the stands in the Central Asian countries, and they were, their long range bases, and still maybe, is to contain the expansion of China to the west, and in Vietnam it was to create bases in Laos and North Vietnam and in South Vietnam, where they did have bases, and in Laos to contain China's advance to the south. And that was because, of course, at a certain point they knew about the split between the Soviet Union and China. But I, So I just wanted to get that in. That's a very interesting parallel, I think, that will continue after the end of the Iraqi war.
I'm speaking with Carol Brightman, who is the author of Total Insecurity, The Myth of American Omnipotence, out from Verso. And let's talk about that subtitle. What about American omnipotence?
It's all in the subtitle.
And what does it have to do with these displays of bravado that Bush is so fond of?
Well, the book is really not about... Well, Bush is a figure at the very end and at the very not in the very beginning, but say in the third chapter. But it's not about Bush. It's about the so-called American empire, and that I think it's, you know, grinding to a halt. And I hate to say it because I'm not an economist, but I think the real evidence of that is in the economy, the international economy, and the U.S. role in it. And so the myth of American omnipotence has to do with looking more closely at the ways in which the U.S. has lost ground in its military posture and it diplomatically. In fact, it has no allies, you know, no pals, no friends, and not even necessarily through fear, which was, of course, Bush's original notion, and economically. And those three areas, I think, you know, they require a great deal of discussion, but in those three areas, the U.S. position is very, very far from the leadership position, which was the idea of it under Clinton. I don't think it was a reality under Clinton either. That's my opinion. But and I try to go back. I don't know how much you've looked at the book, but I try to go back five or six administrations to show... With the Reagan administration and the Kennedy administration being the key ones to show the events that mark the turning of the United States. This is a very unpopular point of view that I have about the myth of American omnipotence, which I take seriously, and I think Bush is just the sort of laughingstock end of a certain stage of it. But by no means the end of it. The Kerry administration, the Kerry campaign, is trying to behave like the old war party that the Democrats always were, and they would make a much more effective war party in the Middle East than Bush is. I know that doesn't sound, but they would. But things have gone so far under Bush. Things are so bad in the Middle East, in Iraq. There is such a difference between the military leadership, which is, and the White House on what to do in Iraq, that I don't know if there'd be a chance for Kerry to have his way with Iraq if he won the election.
Yeah, it almost looks like the hubris involved in invading Iraq actually exposed the weakness underlying the empire. We've got this United States can't occupy a country of 20 million people. It's completely held at bay by a resistance we can't even understand.
Yeah, which is changing, you know, by the day, and has in fact, of course, become, you know, does I guess it does really now include that fellow whose name I never can pronounce, the Z, starts with a Z. From Jordan, the guy who is said to be close to Al Qaeda, but in fact is not.
That's the one that Cheney says is the link between Iraq and Al Qaeda. Yeah,
but he had a real falling out with Al Qaeda quite a while ago.
Yeah, but they're very desperate.
What?
They're very desperate to prove that link.
I know. I just now realize that they no longer say alleged. You know, it's just sort of said. I don't even know myself if it's really a link, if it's really there. But it's true that the insurgents who are carrying out car bombing, that is not a technique of Muqtada al-Sadr or of the Sunni, or the Fallujah people. That's definitely, I think, something that comes may come from out of country because it seems to be targeted as much at Iraqis, if not more, Iraqis who are in service to the United States as to American soldiers who are not in evidence on the streets of, certainly not in the streets of Baghdad. So I think, you know, That's just, that's really happened in the last few weeks, that change or that domination. It's almost as if, you know, for 3 or 4 weeks you have Muqtada, you have the Mahdi's militia, Muqtada al-Sadr's group, you know, and they're taking on the whole U.S. military. I mean, these guys are not professional soldiers, and they're very, very young. And then it draws to a close. They neither win nor lose, but in a sense, you know, they certainly win because they walk away without having been defeated or told they had to disarm for long. And then the Sunnis, of course, they ended their, Sunnis who were in charge of the Ba'athist cities of Samarra and Fallujah and Ramadi and Baquba, I guess. You know, they finished their taking on the U.S. military in May. And of course now their cities are being bombed very much in the way in which the bombing, the war went on in Vietnam, all from the air. So now you have the car bombings. And I'm not so sure who's carrying that out. You know, I don't know. I'm not over there, and I haven't been over there.
Yeah, there's a story, I think it was in The Independent, I saw the other day, that opened with a vignette of a guy who works in one of the ministries in the Iraqi government driving with a mortar shell strapped under his car and driving over to one of those positions where they're, you know, shelling the green zone, the administrative center of Baghdad. Shoots off his mortar and then goes to work at one of the ministries. So if they've got Iraqi government people working against them, you know, they really, it seems like they've lost this battle.
That they've won?
It seems like they've lost the battle, the U.S.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back a little bit to the Kennedy years when you said the strains the lack of omnipotence of the empire first started to show. You report being in college and watching the Kennedy-Nixon debate and not being terribly impressed by, not as impressed by Kennedy as your classmates were. What was happening then?
Well, that was so long ago. I was raised in sort of Democratic. My father, who was kind of a blowhard, was a Democrat, was a liberal. And so I was in some ways reacting against that, but he was so tickled, you know, to have Kennedy come in. But I was very uneasy with Kennedy's eagerness to take on the Third World, and I don't think we used that phrase then, but you know, very soon after 1960, he was definitely. First it was Laos, then it was Vietnam. But you asked about 1960 in those debates, which was before he was even president. And that's a good question. I don't know what it was. It was his, why I saw him as sort of sleazy, you know, and I just dismissed Nixon completely. And I wasn't a political person, really. I mean, I wasn't, well, in some ways I was, but I didn't even know the words. But I just saw him as dangerous because he was so popular, and that was a kind of a reaction to the popularity of him. But then, as soon as he became president and he articulated his foreign policy, I was very definitely opposed to Kennedy, and I was pretty much alone in my generation as a, you know, I quoted. Don't think I had many companions in that. And it was then later, when Viet Report started, I think it was 66 or 7, 65 maybe. Yes, it was 65. And I wrote a piece where I really articulated that idea that's in that chapter about Kennedy going to challenge the nuclear parity that the U.S. had achieved with the Soviet Union, the détente, in a sense, and was going to take on, quote-unquote, limited war, which was a concept of Henry Kissinger's, one of his early ones. In fact, he wrote a book about that around that time. And Vietnam would be the, Indochina would be the site for this challenge where the U.S. would take on the Soviet Union, really, but not directly. But Vietnam was an indirect stab at the Soviet Union. And they had no idea at that time, as we know from McNamara, that you know, that Vietnam was its own force and had its own history and had been carrying out wars like this and for 800 years, if you want to include China and so on. But I definitely had a reaction, a very strong negative reaction to that that position of Kennedy's. It was so strong that it's lasted all these years. And it's sort of it's what makes me remember and remind a lot of my friends, who of course are a much younger generation, that the Vietnam was a democratic war.
Well, when Bob Dole said all the wars of the 20th century have been Democrat wars, he's actually right, wasn't he?
That's right. I mean, it's Truman and there's Roosevelt.
We're running low on time, but do you see any parallels between that JFK and JFK II, another senator from Massachusetts?
JFK II?
John Forbes Kerry.
Teddy. You mean Teddy?
No, John Kerry is...
John Kerry.
Yes, John
Kerry.
Do
I see any similarity?
Yeah.
No. When Kennedy and Kennedy. No, it's funny that he hasn't... No, and in fact, of course, Vietnam, we lost. And that, I think, is a good part of the problems that the Democrats have, is that the war party business changed in 1975 when the war ended, and so Kerry has no place to go on that level. His only moment of glory was in 1972. Was it 72 when he came home? No.
Mm-hmm.
72?
71, 72, something like that.
71, 72. And he's chosen not to honor it. During his winter soldier period, and I'm not talking about the swift boats, but I'm talking about after when he came home. No, I don't see much similarity.
What do you think he would try to sort of recast the Democrats as a more effective war party than the Republicans have been?
I don't know if he has the ideas to do it. He hasn't been forthcoming, shall we say. Either that or he has no ideas about international policy, foreign policy. But he has some people around him who do. And so, I don't know. I just have to say that. I would just be sounding off if I predicted what he would do as president along these lines. I don't think he would last long because the U.S. can't maintain itself without... With the economy in the condition that it's in, he wouldn't last long in the Middle East. Whether he would continue to build U.S. bases around oil, I don't know if he would do that. That would be very critical. That hasn't necessarily worked, but it almost is an obvious tack for the U.S. to take. I mean, obvious that why Bush did that, or Cheney, if you want to talk about that. Why he did that, so I don't know whether we would continue that.
All right, well, actually, we're out of time now. This clock is at 5:55. So thank you for joining us, Carol Brightman.
Okay.
Carol Brightman is the author of Total Insecurity: The Myth of American Omnipotence, and didn't get a chance to explore her theories for why the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan happened, but you can. Do that by picking up a copy of the book, which has just been published by Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Next week, an interview with Michael Hart, who is the co-author of Multitude, along with Antonio Negri, the successor to their international mega-hit bestseller, Empire. So that will take up most of next week's show. Until next week, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with a little more apocalyptic punk rock from Bad Religion. This one, L.A. is Burning.